Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today, my guest is Akash Banerjee, more popularly known as the Deshbhakt. Akash is a political and social satirist. He hosts the Deshbhakt, recognized as India's most influential and widely viewed political satire platform. The Deshbhakt distinguishes itself by blending factual analysis with a mix of sarcasm and dark humor, addressing the challenges facing modern India. Prior to venturing into digital realm, Akash had an extensive career spanning over 15 years in traditional media. His diverse roles included working as a radio jockey, news reporter, anchor, and author. Akash's educational background is equally impressive, having attended St. Stephen's and Hindu colleges in Delhi. In this episode, I talked to Akash about the Pran Pratishtha at Ayodhya, his analysis of 9 years of the BJP government and the 2024 elections. Please do like, share, and subscribe this channel, Shortcast Over Coffee, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. It will mean the world to me. So without further ado, let's dive right in. Hello, Akash. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. I'm sorry it took so much time for us to sync this, but that's my fault. Just trying to grapple things and manage everything together. But thanks for having me over.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it worked out perfectly because now we can talk about Pran Pratishtha, the event that happened yesterday.
Absolutely.
How do you see it? Is this really a new chapter in Indian history?
Given what we witnessed yesterday, the kind of fervor all over the nation. I mean, it's not like it was unexpected, but very clearly, the ideas of India. I mean, we are firm proponents of the Constitution of India, of liberal values, of secularism, of democracy. But you might say the Nehruvian concept, so as to say, of democracy, of the India, has definitely shifted. I mean, one would be fooling themselves to think that the whole concept and the ideas of India that we grew up with over the last so many decades is the same. It has gone through a very, very, very big radical shift. And now it is much more driven by identity, driven by religion. Although stupid people like us would still like to believe that the people who were behind this whole movement, and I have seen this whole Ram Janmabhoomi movement as a kid in Uttar Pradesh. I belong to Uttar Pradesh from the demolition of Babri when I was about 12 to the whole litigation process, to the BJP going from two seats to, people are saying, 350 this time. Not an impossible goal, 350 plus. And we did an episode also on this. It has been a very, very tumultuous issue. It has been a very complicated issue. And I am old enough to remember when people used to say, what is the problem? There is one temple that we are asking for. Does Lord Ram not deserve a place? Does Hinduism not deserve an epicenter? Absolutely. And I think there was a large section even in the other communities, including the Muslim community, who said, if this is the point, if this is what you're saying is that this is what you need, and then we can move on as a nation, let's do it. And we have said it consistently over the last 5 years on Deshbhakt also, build the temple, but then let's focus on national building. And that's what we did in an episode last week also. After Ram Mandir, can we now start building Ram Rajya? So I see it as a possible end of one chapter. The question is, what is the next chapter that we are going to open? Are we going to open the chapter of Ram Rajya, a welfare state with socio-political equality, with fair justice? Or we are going to open another page of saying that Ayodhya to jhaki hai, Kashi Mathura baki hai. And then we start this whole process all over again with Gyanvapi and Shaheed Gah Mosque. That is the big question.
Yeah, I think there's a huge debate about the rollback, right? The rollback from a Muslim mosque to a Hindu temple. And if you start doing it, where do you even stop, right? There's going to be one after the other. And like you said, Gyanvapi can be the next one. So it is important to focus on issues now that it's over with. And I think you brought up a very interesting point where people from the other communities who were also like, you know, just get it over with, you know, just get it done with, build the temple and just move on. So that was also one of the arguments that was made in the Supreme Court, right? That, hey, for the other community, it's not a huge deal. Like it's not a location of any prominence, but for Hindus, it's something that's really close to their hearts. So just build the temple. So yeah, what happens next is going to be very interesting. But I want to just double down on the whole politics and religion aspect a little more. And, you know, I saw a lot of posts on social media yesterday by centrists and sort of leftists who put the photo of the preamble on their social media. What are your thoughts on keeping religion and politics completely separate? And the reason why I'm asking this is, you know, though we speak about keeping them separate, we can't disregard the fact that Hindu religious and charitable endowments department with the Tamil Nadu government, and there is like the Devaswam board in Kerala, which manage temples. So one of the arguments that I hear a lot is that, hey, you're okay getting the money and the revenue from the temples. Why do you have to, you know, talk about delinking politics and religion? What is your take on it?
You know, this whole argument has often been raised, ki, are we even secular? Are we, you know, have we ever separated religion from state? And for a population of 1.45 billion, the main argument that is propounded is the Devasam board and the temples. We did an episode also because it really intrigued me also. I mean, one of the stuff, the kind of things that we do on Deshbhakt is basically what our members ask us and what really intrigues us.
One of the interesting news article that recently I saw was, I think it was last year, that the Andhra government is going to, you know, build a single, like a temple in each village. And they're going to build like 1,400 temples. And mind you, Andhra is not governed by BJP. It's governed by Jagan Mohan Reddy and his party, right? And until very recently, Andhra also had an endowments department, which recently freed temples from government control and gave it back to the trust. So very interesting. Even the non-BJP states have something similar. So would love to have your take on it. Yeah.
For that, in that matter, you know, the Congress also tries to steal a little bit of credit by saying, dekho, taale to humne hi khulwaye the, as far as the Babri Masjid is concerned. I think every party tries to capitalize on religion. I mean, it's happening the world over. I think no party is not guilty. You see the Aam Aadmi Party doing all their part, and that is definitely not the character of the Aam Aadmi Party when it came into power or when it struggled. It was all about corruption and welfare and good governance, and suddenly you see this happening. Even the TMC, which is the only party I think which directly contradicted by saying that this is a political event, but they were also they have also played with religion. So whether be it America, whether be it England, whether be it everybody's trying to, you know, get the either the Bible in and of course in the Muslim dominated country. So religion obviously plays a very, very big important part. The question is, should it or should it not? In a practicing, in a free, in a liberal, in a progressive democracy, it should not, but it does. As far as the Devasam board and the controlling of temples, you know, this argument is often propounded. I find this argument just like ki jab koi ruling party se koi pakda jata hai, to wo kehta hai, nahi, wo to Congress bhi karta tha. Just because Congress karta hai, doesn't make it any more legitimate for any other party to do it. Although in the Devasam board also, what the facts and what the history says is, there was a lot of temple mismanagement. There was a lot of corruption. Therefore, the government took over. And I would be very happy when the government actually gives it back. As far as a constitutionalist is concerned, as far as a centrist is concerned, we see that there is absolutely no role that the government should have in the private matters of religion. Religion for me is a matter of the bedroom. Would I want to discuss what I do in my bedroom with my partner? No. Would I want to discuss how many times I want to pray? Who do I pray to? How fervently I pray? What position do I pray in? I would not. That is the ideal state. Does it happen? No, it doesn't happen. Should it happen for the welfare of this country? Especially a country that is as diverse. So when we talk about diversity and unity in diversity, a lot of people come up and say that, what are you talking about? Why are you even daring to say that, you know, Pakistan crumbled is because they tried to enforce one leader, one nation, one language, one religion. And therefore Bangladesh, I mean, that's a direct example. And why it split, and why it's also very important for India to maintain its diversity. And they say, look at China. And then I have to say, look at the makeup of China, which is 90% Han Chinese. They anyways, as a population, are largely singular. And of course, what they have done with the Muslims there. But then, of course, that's majoritarianism playing there also. The fact is that if you bring in and keep bringing in religion beyond a certain point of time, you will understand that this is not working. Today, India's economy was really at the cusp of taking off. But if you talk to the experts, if you talk to the data experts, if you look at the numbers, that takeoff is not really happening. We are of the generation of liberalization. And why we are very fervently interested in the government focusing only on development is because we've seen the boon of 1991 and what 1991 and the economic liberalization did. And we see that subsequent to that, we haven't had that sort of the kind of hockey stick growth that we were supposed to have. Today, this week, as this whole temple inauguration is concerned and the Prime Minister is busy in that for the last 11 days, we are coming to understand government figures that FDI investment is at a 16-year low. Private companies' profit is at a 14-quarter low. Whereas we should have had a hockey stick growth, what we are seeing is actually deceleration, degrowth. We are talking about deindustrialization. I don't even want to get into the number of unemployment that we have at this point of time. And a recent education report also said how sad is the state of rural education in this country, which we don't want to talk about. But the fact is that 14 to 18 year olds don't even know basic class 2-3 maths. How are they going to become laborers in factories? Even for factories, you have to have basic cognitive skills, which they don't have. These are the issues that are very important. And my, and maybe a few little other idiots in this country who would like to believe, is that if the government focuses on this, and let the people focus on their own religion rather than using it as a political tool. Has it been used as a political tool? Yes. Do other parties want to use it as a political tool? Absolutely. Has the BJP been able to use it better than other parties? No question about it, because they do whatever they do it much, much better than any other party that tries to do it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you spoke about education in particular, right? I've had a lot of guests talk about the education and the lack of skills of people who graduate out of college in India, especially the tier two, tier three colleges. A lot of the times, the government or, you know, the propaganda is that, hey, British came and ruled us for 150 years. There is colonial hangover. They sort of crippled the education system. And there is this NEP, new education policy, that's going to transform everything. Where do you think all of that is going on?
I'm sure that you are aware of our IT revolution, right? I'm sure you are aware of India's IT prowess and how our software engineers are looked at all over the world. Had it not been the British, I don't know what language they would have been coding in, and whether they would have been really the people who were so in demand as far as scientific, STEM, etc., etc. This whole habit of blaming everything on the past to hide your failures is going to work. It's going to work for maybe another 5, 10 years, 15 years, beyond which the people will say, you know, a lot of people find it very thing. Let the BJP do. I said, of course, the Congress has been guilty of many things. The BJP, can we also start questioning the party that has been in power? But unko to time hi kitna hua hai. And then their mind gets blown when I tell them that over the last 25 years, Congress and the BJP have ruled this nation equal amount of time. Because, you know, modern day BJP fans forget that there was another BJP in power and a man called Atal Bihari Vajpayee, who followed the same principles, maybe not as hardcore, but softer. And there have been many things that happened under him also. So to say that Modi's 10 years now and Vajpayee 16 years, and then, so that's actually not 25, it's 30. So if you look at 30 years of history, 15 years now has been ruled by the BJP, 15 years has been ruled by the Congress. Can we grow up and stop blaming the past for all the ills of India? Because this Nehru ki galti is funny to a certain extent of time, but then you also understand that how it manages to pervade even into the educated class. That, oh, because Nehru did something, Nehru did, and when you rule a country for such a long time, you will have your faults. Just like the present prime minister will have it, have his fault, Nehru will also have his fault. Was 1962 an unquantified disaster for Nehru? Yes. There's no two ways about it. But to blame everything to the extent that some of the what we call in Hindi chudbaiya netas, mane, small leaders of the BJP would say that no, price rise today is also because of Nehru. So beyond a certain point of time, it stops being funny. But people believe this. Do I believe so? I believe so. Nehru did what he had to do. Indira Gandhi did a lot of wrong things. You don't see Indira Gandhi being critiqued. I wonder why. Because under her is actually when the democracy of India was actually throttled. But you never hear anything bad about Indira Gandhi. I find it very fascinating. Then Rajiv Gandhi did what he had to do. He got entangled in corruption cases as he did. Then you had some coalition governments. Then Narasimha Rao had to do what he had to do. Politicians do what they need to do. Congress came under a lot of fire because of corruption cases. No doubt about it. One of the reasons why BJP gets so many votes, besides its own very slick, very well-done machinery, whether it be media, whether it be management, whether it be electoral management, it's because the intense hate that people have for the Congress party for two things, obviously. Corruption, a taint that still hasn't gone away, and of course, nepotism, which the BJP has been able to play brilliantly. But having said all of this, ki acha Congress ki galti hai, acha Congress ka nepotism hai, acha Congress ka corruption hai, aapne kya kiya hai? Where is your core achievement besides media management? Is because what I remember of 2014 is the BJP that came into power only talking about Vikas. I don't hear that word anymore. Why are laborers from Haryana going and begging for jobs in Israel? I can understand people going abroad. Absolutely. Full respect. You should go abroad, seek better fortunes for yourself. But you're replacing Palestinian laborers who were anyways treated so badly by the Israelis. So you are replacing one of the most impoverished, one of the most underrepresented labor class. Is that your, sorry to use the word, aukaad? Is that our aukaad? I'm sorry. Indians go abroad for Google, Microsoft, NASA. I am very proud when CEOs, I won't say Indian, Indian origin CEOs become heads of multinational companies. Great. But going to Israel to replace Palestinians and Israel. And by the way, Israel didn't find any other place in the whole goddamn world. They are trying to woo laborers from, because nobody in his right mind might want to go there. That's the problem. When you're talking about GDP, saying that we will go to 5 trillion, your internal strength has taken you to a certain extent. But where are the companies? Where are the jobs? Where is the education? I would like to gauge my government according to these parameters. Is it stupid? Do people really care? Maybe not. But ki farak penda, we'll keep doing it.
Mm. Yeah, you mentioned about the hockey stick kind of growth. And I feel like it's very difficult to communicate the fact that we have not achieved the kind of growth that we should have. Because, you know, let's say I am the government and I say that, hey, we have achieved 8% GDP growth. People would be like, wow, we have achieved 8% GDP growth. And it's, you know, above so many other countries. So people will be just happy about it, right? But they sometimes discount the fact that we should have achieved 11%. So how do you think that communication is extremely difficult, right? Like less profit is still profit, but at the same time, you are not as dejected as you should be.
So I have seen a change. Earlier, we used to get abused on our YouTube platform by saying, no, you are lying. These are not facts. Yeah. Now they say, no, we understand that you are not anti-national. You are speaking for us. You are reflecting the bitter truth. But But listen, we are doing okay. I mean, it's not like, okay. We are not like hockey stick growth or great, but we are still doing okay, right? Why are you being so negative? And that you're absolutely right, is that are we doing okay or are we doing minimal? Is because the benchmark, because of brilliant communication, has been reduced so low. Oh, the world is screwed. Therefore, we are little screwed. We are not so screwed. We are little screwed. Oh, look at Pakistan. It's imploding. We are at least growing. So the communication really matters. And the opposition, of course, has failed in this communication. What people don't realize is that even if you talk about a $5 trillion economy, you have to grow at minimum 8% 5 years straight. Then you might get to a $5 trillion economy by 2028. Because what happens is, and this is where the brilliance, I mean, I used to laugh. I don't laugh at politicians anymore. Is because they are saying, are 1 trillion tha, then became 2 trillion. Now we are 3 trillion. So automatically 5 trillion. It's not mathematical. Going from 3.5 trillion to 5 trillion is completely a different maths. It's a different set of challenges. It is not 1 plus 1 is equal to 2 or 2AB, as a famous politician said. So the point is the communication, the education, even the opposition hasn't been good enough to explain to people that today, while the overall growth numbers still look decent, no doubt about it, that, oh, other countries, but they forget that other countries have already achieved a state of growth. Their 2%, 3% is also okay compared to our. We need to grow at least 8%. Very difficult concept for them to understand. But they will not even accept the fact. And oh boy, the amount of abuse I've had when I've said, I am not saying it. IMF is saying it, that over the course of next 5 years, Bangladesh's per capita GDP would be more than ours. So I tried to explain it in the language that they would understand. Achha, theek hai, tu Pakistan ko itna mazak udate ho. Ye dekho, chotu sa Bangladesh. Why is it having more per capita income than you are having? That is when it may be a little bit of a light bulb goes off. Ki wa, and of course, to understand the concept of per capita GDP, which people don't, I mean, I try to explain it to them simply. That is when they realize that, okay, something might be going wrong here. So people need to understand what is jobless growth? What is GDP that is being driven by the size of the economy, not by personal welfare? They need to understand why 80 crore people are on ration. If people are getting out of poverty, why is the government having to give a dole of 80 crore people being on food subsidy free ration by the government? You can't have both ways. Either you say, and the irony is, leftist bahut bola jata hai. And I completely agree that, bhaiya, I am absolutely against the left form of government or the left form of free dole. But Modi is one of the biggest leftists, because no other prime minister in recent memory would have given 80 crore people free ration. And now it has been extended to the next 5 years. What is this? It is social welfare. It is socialism. Ab aap isko leftist keh do, but socialism is not left. But anyways, so what is happening is, of course, few people are getting a lot more rich. And that is why Rolls Royces and Mercedes are flying off the shelf in India. No debate over that. There is a class in India, the upper 1% or maybe 0.5% of that 1%, which is doing fabulous. But that is belying the fact is that your large parts of the country are not. Why are the large parts of the country not speaking up? That is the brilliance of politics, is because the large parts of the country have been told, we are working on your pride. We are working on your identity. We have built this temple for you. We have protected you. We have taken care of your national security. Otherwise, maybe Pakistan would have been ruling over us, etc., etc.
Mm. Yeah, you. I was actually laughing when you said about the top, 1% or 0.05% who are buying all the Benzes and BMWs and Rolls Royces. And I got reminded of one of the things that you mentioned in your Pakistan video fairly recently, is about the trickle down effect. Do you think that's that's the first stage of an economy growing, like where some people become rich and that kind of trickles down. And in Pakistan's case, there was no environment for it to trickle down. You know, there were so many other things that happened that did not lead it to trickle down. And given the situation in India, do you think that is a possibility?
I have won so many debates in Delhi University with the trickle-down effect because it sounds as such a nice concept. As a person who runs a company, as a person, you know, a lot of people get shocked. Oh, tum capitalist apne aap ko kaise kehte ho? Bhaiya, main capitalist hoon. I run a company. I employ 6 people. I give them a salary. I'm a capitalist. It sounds nice. But I don't think it works. I do not think a trickle-down effect will work in isolation unless and until that there is some governmental regulation to ensure that that trickle is actually happening. Look at it logically. Look at it as human beings. We would want to maximize profits. I'm not stating a secret. Every company would like to maximize profits. And that is why companies would shift manufacturing out of America and into the sweatshops in Southeast Asia. Maximization of profit is the essence of capitalism. Now, on the other hand, you're telling me is that no, while the capitalist will maximize their profits, it will trickle down. It will trickle down to the effect. I still remember one amazing guy from Philippines who said that don't make fun of sweatshops is because when you're making fun of sweatshops or you're criticizing sweatshops, you're making mockery of my mother who's earning a $3 per hour or $2 an hour. But what was she doing before that? Prostitution. In that sense, extracting people from the worst to maybe barely sustenance, I would agree that, okay. But is a sweatshop the be-all and end-all of welfare and capitalism? Maybe not. And that is why, again, in America, out of all places, you are having people getting into unions. You saw that whole Hollywood strike that just happened, and they managed to extract their pound of flesh. Now, are unions leftist or are unions something which is, I would say, it's social welfare, where you are fighting for what you think you deserve? Of course, unions can be politicized, and we've seen the bad aspects of union politics as well in India with the cotton mills, etc., in Bombay being shut down.
Kerala. But the fact also, is that huge examples,
if you leave it to the capitalists, then it will not trickle down. And that is why we have to have capitalism. I am all for it. But you can't have monopolies and duopolies. That is bad. And you can't have complete laissez-faire where the government says, let the capitalists do what they want to do and they will do for the bhala of people. No. And that is why even in advanced countries like America, you have something called a minimum wage. And there is a raging debate over how the minimum wage should be raised is because a capitalist will pay the minimum wage as much as minimum as possible. Then how is the trickle down going to work then when I'm going to pay minimum?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's another reason why the whole hockey stick doesn't happen even with the person's mother in Philippines, right? I mean, because she shifted from really, really bad to bad. That's it. And if we leave it to capitalists, the trickle-down effect is going to be extremely slow unless government plays a role with like antitrust laws and so on, minimum wage and so on. Yeah, really interesting. You touched on Nehru, and I feel like Nehru is criticized a lot without giving a thought on the circumstances in those days. And hindsight is such a funny thing, right? And that also reminds me of the debacle that happened with the 1962 war. And I think that's one of the things that Nehru is criticized for quite a bit. And there was this Henderson-Brooks report that was authored around the time, which details about the strategies that the Indian military took and some of the extremely poor decisions that happened during the 1962 war. And there was a lot of debate about if that needs to be declassified. And so in India, I think after 25 years, the military documents are declassified. I think in the US, it's 50. But the declassification of the Henderson-Brooks report did not happen. And I think parts of it were released by an Australian journalist, I think Neville Maxwell, his name was, around probably 9-10 years ago, right before the first Modi government came into picture. And the reason why I'm asking this or talking about this is declassifying information important? Is giving public an idea of what happened 25, let's say 30 years ago, important? And what role do these things play in an election? Because this happened right before the 2014 election, if I remember correctly. And there was a bit of a jitter.
So, of course, the government can continue to hold on to documents and not declassify them, citing national security and national interests. So there is no year that can be followed. It all depends really on who wants to declassify the government and which dispensation is in power. Having said that, I would definitely say that if there is no clear and present danger, which, of course, the government would like to believe suiting on its own politics, we should have more declassification of documents, is because what it does is leads to more conspiracy theorists. Tomorrow, somebody might just get up and make a movie saying 1962, Nehru was involved with the Chinese. And I'll make a movie on that. Kya kar loge aap? You can't do anything about it. It's my creative expression. I will make a movie. Like in the beginning of just about a year ago, exactly to this date, you had a movie called The Kerala Story that came out. Which talked about 40,000 women from Kerala who have been made into sex slaves that are rotting in graves in Afghanistan, etc., or in Syria, while the real number is about 3. And the government number who have tried to sneak out has been in the range of about 100, 120 who went to join ISIS, which is, of course, not a good thing at all. But if he had made a movie saying that 120 people had tried to join ISIS versus 40,000 women are rotting in the graves, then the whole movie would have been a dip, but the movie earned 300 crore rupees. I could theoretically imagine 10 years down the line, somebody would want to make a movie saying that Modi was responsible for Galwan. Is because I can show images of Modi sitting with Xi on a jhula, smiling, looking at him benevolently, and then put some images of our soldiers and shoot a cheap video of our soldiers being attacked by the Chinese. And that movie could be titled, or the trailer would go, that when our soldiers were being attacked, Modi was sipping tea with Xi. That is how political propaganda is manufactured. And when time passes by, you can create your own version of history. And that is why you would have the vaccine files, for example, which I think was one of the most well-crafted propaganda movies of 2023, because I went to see what would Vivek Agnihotri do after the success of the Kashmir files. The Kashmir files was part propaganda, part reality. The reality was Kashmiri Pandits have suffered. The reality was the governments of that time completely, bitterly failed, and nothing came out of that, and no lessons were learned, and Kashmiri Pandits continue to suffer. Then you magnify that and make it into a full genocide, the official Kashmiri Pandit figures is in the range of 600 plus or something like that, which you make into 6,000, 60,000, whatever. And you give it completely a religious angle. While terrorists in Kashmir will kill anybody, Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, they will kill their own brothers, the terrorists being sent across the border. So it was more of geopolitics than of religion. Religion was a tool. That point not being explained. So what will happen is, this whole aspect, and, you know, a lot of people started asking us, why are you doing movie reviews on Deshbhakt? And just look at the plethora of movies that are coming in, from Prime Minister Modi's own movie to accidental Prime Minister that came just before the 2019 elections. A lot of people said that there was an element of propaganda in Uri also. Atal Bihari Vajpayee's movie just came out, which tries not to be propaganda, but there are shades of it.
Thanks to a good director.
So some are very shabbily made. Some are decently made. Pankaj Tripathi, of course, is a great actor, no doubt about that. But what one needs to understand the shades of propaganda, the shades of brainwashing, the shades of facts being mauled to death that are happening, whether be it mainstream, whether be it WhatsApp. And since we are having this discussion, let's not completely forget how this nation is getting educated at this point of time. It is not through this podcast conversation. It is not even news channels or YouTube. it is more or less of WhatsApp. Whatever information is coming there, it is unfiltered bile, it is unfiltered lies, it is unfact-checked facts, and people are believing it as the gospel.
Yeah, you touched on Bollywood a little bit, and I see that you do cover quite a bit of Bollywood. And sometimes I wonder, you know, the indie sort of movies that were made in probably the early 2000s or even the late 2000s, like Bheja Fry or a Khosla Ka Ghosla, I don't really see those movies coming out anymore. And I don't see those movies getting packed theaters. And it has completely become about... I think a new movie called Fighter is releasing, which is, again, this whole India versus Pakistan thingy. Do you miss such movies? And what is your take on this whole mass masala? I think there is a sense of marvelization of Indian movies as well that's going on.
I wish it was just marvelization. It is marvelization with massive doses of bigotry and hate. And ultra nationalism, actually, not nationalism. Bheja Fry was made, if I'm not wrong, with a budget of 1 crore. And that movie went on to become a cult hit. Khosla Ka Ghosla went on to become a cult hit. Again, a small budget movie. It reflected the trials and tribulations of the common man, the middle class. And I am a big champion of movies that talk about the issues of the middle class. I was euphoric after seeing Jawan, and you know, folks for the Deshbhakt family are saying, why are you like so excited? This is every other South Indian movie. Because South Indian movies do talk about social realities. Bollywood doesn't. Bollywood is iski dulhaniya, uski shadi. They don't talk about social realities. To talk about social realities and make it into in a masala movie where people are seeing the social reality, but they are not being turned off. Like, it is not becoming an art movie. I would say is an art in itself. And something that Bollywood has had forgotten earlier, it used to do. Earlier, of course, it used to do. But not anymore. So, I would say that Bollywood is playing... We cover these movies is because, honestly, there is a lot of social reality that can be highlighted with Bollywood movies. And that's what we don't cover every Bollywood movie, but anything that has a social reality or a political connection, we try to cover, is because this has a huge impact on the mindset of people. Did Kashmir Files increase distrust and hate towards the minority community? My answer would be yes. Did Kerala Story changed the perception of Kerala and make people think that it's some sort of ISIS haven? I would tend to agree, yes. Is because even today, when I say that Kerala Story was a pack of lies and the Supreme Court had to intervene, I get abused. But people will not know this, that the Supreme Court has said, you will put that this is a fictionalized version, and they have to mandatorily state it before screening the movie, that this is a work of fiction. While the director had said, no, this is facts that I've made this movie on. So therefore taking the legs off it, but that was unfortunately after the movie had already become popular. So that is why it is very important to keep a track about movies. We will definitely see Fighter next Friday. It's because we want to see what does it do. Remember, Gadar, Sunny Deol's Gadar Part 2, raked in 500 crores. You will see the movie and you will say, what just happened? What is there in this movie to rake in 500 crores? There is nothing. They've used the tapestry of Gadar 1, packed it into Gadar 2, but there is no story, there is no ethos. But it was one of the biggest hits of 2023. So Fighter is trying to do the same thing. But imagine a Maverick where Tom Cruise is looking at a Chinese or a Russian guy and saying, main teri phod dunga, main teri maar lunga. That sort of cheap language and cheap playing on nationalism. And here is what I find very fascinating. Does nationalism and ultra-nationalism and Pakistan bashing sell? Akshay and Kangana were the superstars in this genre. All their movies didn't work in the last 1 or 2 years. Kangana's 10 movies have flopped. So it's not always that nationalism and religion are working also. I had high hopes that Akshay's Ram Setu would work. After all, on the Mandir inauguration year, just a few, we are talking about like what, December last year? Anyways, a few months before, but religious fervor, Ram ke naam par picture bani hui hai. It is one of the most mythologically or religiously sensitive issues. It was modeled on National Treasure. And I think National Treasure had had two volumes of it also, where you take a myth or a legend and then you prove, no, this would be a fact. So the premise was great. Or even Kangana's movie, Tejas, India's first woman fighter pilot. I think the premise is great, but it didn't work. Whether it was made shoddily or people did not connect. But this is Pakistan. So Fighter is about Pakistan. And it's high adrenaline. It's Deepika. It has better fighter scenes, at least than Tejas. It'll be interesting to see how does it do. Yeah. Because you see, ultimately people will be the decider. We always forget that ultimately democracy lies in the hearts and minds of the people. If they want this to happen, whatever happened yesterday, for example, and the whole fervor and the Diwali-like celebrations that happened yesterday, they didn't happen by force. Let's not fool ourselves. Of course, there was an RSS outreach and people were told, ki diya jalao and ye sab karo, theek hai. But ultimately, there are people who are doing it. Movies are also conditioning people in that way. Anybody who wants to say otherwise, think otherwise, has to talk in this language, this mass language.
Yeah, talking about movies and movie reviews, Akash, you have been very vocal about nepotism in Bollywood. And I just wanted to ask you about a slightly different aspect of nepotism. So nepotism is everywhere, right? I mean, be it, you know, you see nepotism in the case of Ambani, you see nepotism in the case of Jay Shah, Amit Shah, and all of that. What is it about Bollywood nepotism that is different than all of these?
Yeah. I have been asked this question earlier also, because I comment a lot of movies. I know a few people who are linked to the industry and they're very disappointed, is that why am I so vitriolic? Like, it really angers me. There is nepotism in every field. Okay. Very controversially, there is nepotism in the field of law and judiciary, even sons of judges becoming judges. That's highly controversial because it impacts the nation. Sons of doctors becoming doctors, sons of politicians becoming politicians also. Let's not forget that. But what is amazing about Bollywood is that if I am not a son or daughter or acquaintance of someone, my chances of making it in Bollywood would be virtually 1% to 5%. Is because if you look at the whole list of stars, either they are children of somebody, either they are nieces or nephews of somebody, or they have some other Bollywood connection. You know, I was looking at some of the women faces who are very popular, who are not Nepo kids. They turn out to be the daughters of business friends of producers who may have partially financed the movie also. So what happens is when nepotism chokes off the entire fresh oxygen supply, that is when it becomes poisonous. I do not believe that you can stop nepotism or parents wanting their best for their children. Absolutely okay. But when it becomes the only way to get into an entire industry, imagine I can't become a doctor because my father is not a doctor. Even if I'm cracking the mains and I'm doing amazing stuff, or I can't become a IAS officer. Even today, I can. Of course, my road would be much easier if I'm a Nepo baby in politics. But I can still aspire. There are still opportunities. What Bollywood did was effectively shut down the gates for newcomers from outsiders. There's a reason why the whole Sushant Singh episode blew out so much. And people believed in so many conspiracies. And why Kangana got such a lot of traction. I have ripped Kangana apart so many times. I'm known as one of her favorite baiters. But one thing I agree with Kangana is when she got the initial traction over the Sushant Singh episode, she never knew Sushant. She does not have one picture with Sushant, but then she came out as a champion of Sushant along with Arnab, because everybody wants TRP. But why people agreed with them is because there is a very clear feeling is that he was killed in this whole insider versus outsider battle, that there is an insider's club. And if you are coming from the outside, you will be pushed out. The tolerance level for your actions would be much less. If you give one or two flops, you will be dead. While Nepo kids can continue to give flops after flops and still be megastars. And that is why Shah Rukh Khan is regarded as the ultimate outsider, who was the outsider and who came and made it big in Bollywood. I really think that a lot of Shah Rukh fandom is not about him doing this or him being able to make you cry. Is because people love that journey of this boy from Delhi who came into Bombay and completely ruled over that city. And that is why my mouth fell when a man like Shah Rukh allows his daughter to be the epitome of a Nepo baby. Because I expected better from Shah Rukh. That boss, you have been from an outsider. I'm not saying that you will not allow your daughter to act, by the way. Before Suhana got her first role, she had become this celebrity out of nowhere. She is getting Maybelline contracts worth crores of rupees. And then when her eventually movie came out, and I think Archie's is the nail in the coffin. It just ends the debate as far as Nepo babies are concerned. Is because if that is the output that you get from one of the best directors who spent 1 year on you, and that is the output, I am sorry. You can't. You either have it, you don't have it. But yet, look at how many roles Suhana will keep getting and keep progressing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that strike me about Indian cinema is that, and I've had this discussion with someone else, I can't remember who exactly, but I feel like in India, the culture of going out is not as much as, let's say, in the West, where people, you know, go out camping, go mountaineering, trekking and all of that. So the only way that people can enjoy themselves going out is maybe go to a restaurant or, you know, like temple visits are one of the other means. And the third one being going to a cinema. So this only way of getting entertainment is being choked by this powerful people, right? I mean, and people do not have any option. I mean, it's not just true with Bollywood, even in the South. I think Malayalam industry was, you know, I used to say proudly about the last generation of Malayalam actors that nobody had any connection with movies, like let's say a Mohanlal or Mammootty. But the present generation, I know there are a few outsiders, but it's all, you know, sons and daughters of actors. So it's getting everywhere and it's becoming like this choke point that people just don't have any other option. You know, they just have to watch movies made by the Nepo babies. So it's a very interesting.
And failing on top of that and yet keep on getting chances which the outsider would not get. My point being that also.
Yeah, yeah, that is true. Because I feel like in any other, I mean, I'm not saying acting does not require skill. It definitely does. But in the case of, let's say, a cameraman or a director or a doctor or a lawyer, you still need to have some skills to sustain, right? And this probably has a very low bar of entry. I don't know how the movie industry works, but that's that. So Akash, moving on to YouTube, which is your forte, I see that you had a relatively long stint in the media with Times Now and Mirchi FM, I think it is, and also with India Today. All these channels have transformed themselves over the years. So I just want to know your experience working with them in, you know, late 2000s, if you can comment
so
on it, that is.
As much as possible, I try not to mention Times Now. because you don't want to be associated with the devil. I was in the original launch team of Times Now with Arnab, and I used to be an anchor and a reporter. And I always say this about Arnab is that Arnab has always been fearsome and fiery, and you know, always asking questions and always been very aggressive. And the way he used to ask questions to the government at that point of time and the Congress party is that is what made Times Now And Arnab still does that. Without any fear or favor, he questions. The only problem is he's still questioning the same Congress party, while the government has been now different for about 9.5 years. But I still believe that eventually people will come to respect that sort of journalism, because Arnab cut his teeth and Arnab made his household name questioning the establishment, questioning the system. He was one of the most vociferous critics of the Congress party. But it is so sad to see him as one who has continued to only question the Congress party and defend the party in power. But he was a different person at that point of time when I was working in Times Now from 2005 onwards. He was aggressive at that point of time, but I wanted to question the government. He wanted to question the government. So that was absolutely okay. He's never been an easy boss to work with. His expectations were sky high. Media is a very tough landscape to be in. There is no work-life balance. There is no life. There's no question of balance. There's no life. There's only work. Headlines Today was much more balanced at that point of time. I left Times Now because I didn't want to be in Bombay. I had no other problems with Times Now. It's just that I didn't like Bombay. I wanted to be back in Delhi. And then I went into Headlines Today, worked there for 5 years. Again, I had no... we were talking about till 2012. Even then, media was being disrespected. Media was not growing. But the kind of godiness that we see, the kind of unabashed worshipping of the establishment that we see, wasn't there at that point of time. But I just wanted more growth. I just wanted more challenges. Therefore, I left and went into the world of radio. Actually, I was a radio jockey before I joined television. And when I went back in the managerial side. So worked for 5 years in Radio Mirchi on behind the mic, not in front of the mic, in the management side. And then the YouTube bug struck. And then it was about trying to do satire and information and education on YouTube.
Fantastic. And I mean, what a journey. I mean, I remember following you around 2019, and the meteoric rise has been just ridiculous. And about YouTube, you know, I see that YouTube played a very important role in the recent state elections in Chhattisgarh, Rajasthan, etc. And it is touted to play an even important role in the 2024 elections. And funny enough, the interview with Rahul Gandhi by Arnab in Frankly Speaking just popped up on my YouTube, and I think it's popping up out of nowhere because it's a 9-year-old interview, and I don't remember particularly searching for anything similar, but I guess it's the time that we are in now with all the elections coming in. I actually watched a documentary where an influencer, like a micro, I wouldn't say micro, but like a semi-micro influencer who is a photographer based in the Thar Desert area. I think his page's name is Thar Desert Photography or something. He's getting funded by the Congress to go in and capture how the Modi government has failed in providing employment to rural India and so on. And I also heard political analyst Dilip Cherian say that, you know, local vocal influencers that are not seen as routinely political are going to play an important role in the 2024 elections. So how do you see the whole, you know, world of YouTube shaping the elections this year?
The fact is that, I mean, this is a bit of a news to me that apparently the Congress party is actually funding a small time content creator to go and photograph. I would like to know the contact person of this. Maybe thodi baat kara do. Kyunki, you know,
this was captured by DW, the German version of BBC. So unki ek documentary thi jahan pe unhone capture kiya tha ye.
Kyunki, I am anyways, the allegation always keeps coming ki tumhe Congress se paisa mila hai. So I only say is that, wait, the allegation is not. They say kitna mila hai. It's how much have you got? And the only answer I tell them is that I'm trying to negotiate a 15 lakh contract, but 15 lakh yahan bhi nahi milenge shayad. These guys will also not fulfill their promise. Jokes aside, I find it a little surprising if the Congress is doing this. That's great. Because one of my pet peeves with the opposition parties in India, not just Congress, other opposition parties also, you know, I know how important social media is. You know, I know that it played an important role in 2019. It played an important role in 2014. BJP's master digital media. So at what point in history of India, in which century AD, are they going to understand is that they can't keep crying over mainstream media not with being with them. Mainstream media is not with the opposition is because mainstream media has been pumped with thousands of crores of rupees. They are not there to sing your gunagan. They are not there to sing your praises. They have their balance sheets to manage. And it is extremely, because I worked in news channels and I know how extremely expensive and difficult it is to run a news channel. You have satellite rights, you have on-air time, you have hardware, then you have to pipe your channel into that small bandwidth on people who are still watching cable TV. That you have to make your channel visible, then you have the manpower. It's extremely expensive to run. And that is why either they are run by businessmen who want to just splurge their money or they're run by political parties. Okay. So you haven't understood that. Okay. Even if you don't understand that, what have you done in the world of social media? What have you done in Twitter? What have you... Till recently, I haven't checked of late, our channel was bigger than Rahul Gandhi's channel. I don't say it as a matter of pride. It doesn't give me a chip on my shoulder. At a time when the country's prime minister has his own channel, which is crossing 50, 80, 100, I don't know how many millions and crores, when the prime minister's Instagram is at some obscene 30 million, 40 million followers, have you even tried to occupy the space in the digital media? So what you're talking about, giving money to photographers to catalog the failure or the success of the government, is a far reach. I am saying, what has Rahul Gandhi done? How many people has he followed? How many people has he retweeted? How many conversations is he having? How many posts is he doing? How many he had promised he'll do videos regularly on YouTube? How many of those regular videos are happening? Digital, while the government will try to control digital, is still more relatively flat than television. We have made a subscriber base of 5 to 6 million across 4 platforms without spending 1 rupee. So why can't the opposition, at least, and not only the Congress party, the other opposition parties? There was a time when Aam Aadmi Party used to do social media very well, but again, that also collapsed. What about the other parties? Are they capitalizing on social media? Because the brainwashing or the political influencing or the messaging, whichever category you want to choose, it's all happening on social media. So, it has played an important role. It will continue to play an important role. And that is why you would see, since we are doing a podcast, why are the ministers reaching out to podcasters and having podcast sessions with them? Is because these BJP ministers, at least, have realized that 2024, you would have an entire generation of first-time voters who have never seen a television channel, who have never sat in front of television channel in front of Arnab and watched him do his drama. They are digital natives. Now, how do you tap into the digital natives? Is there a strategy in the opposition parties to tap into the digital natives? I don't think so. So there is a lot more. A lot of people always say, is that, are, but Akash, why are you raising these issues? You know the BJP is going to come. Aayega to Modi hi. I say yes, aayega to Modi hi. I do not think that there is a question about it. The question is, Modi aayega 250 mein ya 350 mein? I think the election is all about 250 versus 350 for the BJP this time. If it is 250, 300, then we get a balanced democracy. If it is 300 plus, then we get an authoritarian democracy. I think that is what we are going to witness over the next 4 months. And that is what we are going to report on. Which sort of democracy are we heading into? And digital will play a very important role in getting us that democracy.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why the situation is such is lack of opposition, right? I mean, you have Mallikarjun Kharge, and there is absolutely no activity from the other side in criticizing. I mean, they criticize for the sake of it, like they are asking for proof for Balakot and whatnot, but it's really not calling them out and criticizing them on valid points, I feel like.
Yeah. So you have to talk in the language of the people. I think what the opposition is still stuck is in a very, very arcane mindset. I'll give you another example. Why only Congress? Look at Let's not forget that when 2004, the Congress came into power, it was not the Congress that came into power. It was the UPA government that came into power. And the left parties had 61 seats. 61 is not a joke in a country like India. The left suddenly swept heartland India and had 61 seats.
I think they nailed Kerala. They probably had like 20 odd in Kerala. It was crazy.
Yeah. So of course, that played a very, very important role in ensuring that, suddenly this the one of the biggest shock defeats in the history of Lok Sabha elections has been really 2004, India shining, Vajpayee almost confident that he's going to come back in power, elections being preponed. I mean, imagine the confidence of the government to prepone the elections.
Yeah, that was a shocker.
yeah, it was a shocker. So the same left party, what is it doing one day before the Ram Mandir inauguration is happening? Country is celebrating a Ram Mandir inauguration. It is seeped in religiosity. And these guys are garlanding Lenin or Stalin and saying Lal Salam.
What is the difference, right? What is the difference between that and this? Like, it's still idol worship, right?
It is. But you also have to see what works and what doesn't. Your action as a political party, you're absolutely right. It is, I mean, if you want to be very, very clear about it, wo bhi ye kar rahe, wo bhi ye kar rahe. Lekin, think about this. And in Vajpayee's biography, Main Atal Hoon, there is Goldwarkar who also comes in the movie. And the role that because Goldwarkar ultimately gave permission for the formation of the Jang Sangh. Otherwise, RSS was completely non-political and RSS had always said that we will be non-political. And therefore, this was a departure that they would have a subsidiary which would not be linked to the RSS directly, but indirectly, but be political. Today, do you see any BJP leader talk about Goldwarkar? Because if they start associating themselves with Goldwarkar, then all the kind of writings of Goldwarkar will come back to hit them. They dissociated themselves from Goldwarkar, one of the shining lights of their ideology, is because he was too hot to handle. The kind of utterances and the kind of stuff that he has written about Muslims, about Christians, about the identity of this country would still, maybe one day, but not right now, is not acceptable. You change your dynamics, you change your politics. Vajpayee, very interestingly also, after the Babri Masjid demolition, stayed away from his party activities for a very long time because he was repenting. So the BJP's official line, and even at that point of time, is "Humne nahi kiya hai." We are also shocked. Today they will say a different tune. But you have to move with the times. Till I was a reporter, and I still used to find it very funny then, in Ajoy Bhavan, in Kolkata, the CPM had Marx, Lenin, Stalin, and somebody else as the main portraits above their press conference desk. That is not going to work. Maybe it worked in 1970s for you, but you failed to evolve. And my point is, whether be it the left parties that left parties could have just taken up social causes, social issues, they still have a lot of ground presence. They didn't move with the times. The TMC couldn't move with the times and expand beyond Bengal. Aam Aadmi Party got stuck into this supreme leader, my leader, who everybody else has to be subjugated. Look at Samajwadi Party and the BSP again stuck in a limbo. So where does this opposition come from? Because they are so self-consumed. And my anger and my frustration is that even imagine 2024 is basically going to decide what, as I said, what sort of democracy are we, an authoritarian one-party democracy? 2024 is going to decide that. There, ek pair kabar mein, literally one leg in the grave. But yet, no sort of reduction in arrogance. A lot of people have said to us, oh, you guys question so much. Then why don't you give space on your channel to the opposition? And then they're shocked when we tell them that I can show you emails, I can show you correspondence that we have asked for interviews from every major political party to come and have a sit-down interview. And they have all refused because they think that we are anti them also. बिकॉज आम आदमी पार्टी पर हमने लिकर बैन पर हमने एपिसोड बनाया, दे आर पिस्ड ऑफ विद अस. कांग्रेस में हमने नेपोटिज्म के बारे में एपिसोड बनाया, दे आर पिस्ड ऑफ विद अस. ममता बैनर्जी इज पिस्ड ऑफ इज बिकॉज वी मेड एन एपिसोड ऑन हाउ बंगाल हैज डीजेनरेटेड ओवर द डेकेड्स इवन आफ्टर द टीएमसी इज कमिंग इनटू पावर. एट एवरी लेवल ऑल दीज पार्टीज आर बीजेपी पार्ट टू. Everybody wants to have a supreme leader. Everybody wants to have media that only wah-wahs them and only, you know, extols their virtues. And you don't have the money that the main party has. What are you doing, guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you discussed about the lack of prominence of the opposition parties on social media. And, you know, recently there was a little bit of activity with the whole Bharat Jodo Yatra. Mm-hmm. And now there is the Bharat Jodo Nyay Yatra, which has started. I mean, I am following everything on social media, but this seems pretty much like a non-event, you know, this Bharat Jodo Yatra. Yeah, someone is walking and that's about it.
So when the Bharat Jodo Yatra happened, it was a new thing. I mean, the concept of Padyatras has been there. Of course, chief ministers have done it over the a lot of times also. But Rahul Gandhi doing a Forrest Gump, Padyatra, Pura Upar Se Niche, it had a novelty value to it and people were interested. Can he do it or not? That was also one of the very important questions. Can he do something like this or not? And he did it. And I really think in the 9-10 years of this BJP government, it did improve the image of Rahul Gandhi to a certain extent. I will make no bones about it. Did it improve the image of the Congress? Did it improve the workings of the Congress? Did it improve the electoral prospects of the Congress? Did it improve the communications of the Congress? No. To the extent, I would also say, is that he went on this whole huge yatra. I mean, this is something that Bapu used to do, Gandhiji used to do, is that he used to have reporters tag along with him, foreign, domestic, whatever, give interviews, etc., etc. This guy sits down and gives interviews to food vloggers. And I'm not talking about that we tried and we did not get an interview. We are insignificant. There were people like Ravish who were walking in the yatra, who had gone and they have done episodes on the yatra. But did you see an interview with Ravish? Do you think Ravish did not try?
I'm sure. Ravish, right? Being Ravish, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
They did not give interviews to anyone because they were scared. Because they are still trying to come out of the Arnab bashing that Rahul Gandhi got so many years ago. It is that whole fear psychology that has seeped in so big, is that my whole reputation will again be destroyed if I give a sit-down interview. That is a big tragedy. So it is going to be a non-event. A, because it is a repetitive event. You've done it this way, now you're doing it this way. I'm sorry, there's no novelty value in it. Look at BJP. It does different things at different point of time. Kabhi hum ye inauguration karenge, kabhi hum ye activity karenge. Achha, abhi hum mandir kar rahe hain. Ab Republic Day aa jayega. Uske baad hum kuch aur naya karenge. There is always something that is happening. You are on top of mind is always happening. The opposition, if it had any chance, I'm saying any chance means, agar BJP ko 250 tak bhi agar lana tha, you had to be on top every day doing something new and doing the things that BJP does not. So if the prime, and Rahul Gandhi has said, achha, theek hai, wo press conference karte hain, fair enough. But if the prime minister doesn't give blunt interviews, you are the one who will go and give blunt interviews. That is what, you are supposed to be the antithesis. But you are largely behaving in the same way in a conditioned environment. Your advisors are saying, isse baat karo, usse mat baat karo. Whereas you don't have the media wherewithal also. And that is why I agree with you. I don't see any impression of Bharat Jodo Yatra or Nyay Yatra, Bharat Jodo Part 2, as much as Part 1 had. I'm not seeing the same traction.
Yeah. You know, that brings me to the same old question that we all have asked over the years, that why is the Congress Party so obsessed with this one person or one family to run it? And would things have been a little different if Shashi Tharoor would have led the AICC and not Mallikarjun Kharge? Just because of this thing that you mentioned about the trauma that Arnab's interview left on the Congress Party, and Shashi Tharoor being Shashi Tharoor, he is extremely confident and he knows what he's talking about. Though I disagree with him on certain religious appeasement things, appeasements that he talks about. But do you think that would have been a little different?
So, one of the things a lot of people ask us is that, Archa, to tum kisi ho, you would also have a soft corner for a party. So I said, payment to nahi milta hai. But sabhi, you would have a soft corner. So I said, yes, we have an official policy on that also. Anybody who we mock, anybody who we joke, and yet that person doesn't get angry with us, with our satire, we have a soft corner for that person. Shashi Tharoor fits into that bill. We mocked Shashi Tharoor. We mocked his English. He's called back and said, no, this is not how I talk. Then we've done a test with him also, vocabulary test, where we've tested his Hindi also. And he was, sportingly enough, his reputation could have been destroyed if he did not get any words. He managed to get a few words also. Very sporting of him. So we are saying that we are okay with that. So having said that, despite the fact I'm saying that we might have a soft corner for Shashi Tharoor, Shashi would not get you the votes. He will not be the mass leader for the Congress. But at least he might get you some of the urban votes. And I remember my CEO once telling me at Mirchi, I said, let's do this program. Let's do this. Let's relaunch this. I had just come in new as the programming head of Delhi. And he remarked, jo karna hai kar lo. Kuch, jo karna hai kar lo. Koi problem nahi hai. Why? Because we are so damn down. Anything that you will do will anyways get us up only. Nah? So go ahead, do anything that... At this point of time, whatever the Congress might do, even if it does it with some honesty, they will at least get out of the 40-50 zone. But given the way they are behaving, they might land up again in the 40-50 zone with the way they are going. So that is why a lot of people have said the Congress, at least the Gandhi, should take a back seat. They should be, the back seat drivers. Even if you don't want to give up power, just withdraw from public appearance, control the strings from the background, and let people do their job. For this, a lot of people say, no, there's no solution. I will give you a solution. I've been trying to give this solution for the last 5 years. And this is not a new solution. UK has something called a shadow parliament. And I've been screaming for 5 years. Why doesn't the opposition also have a shadow parliament? Ki boss, Shashi Tharoor is the Minister of External Affairs, shadow minister. So they have a full concept of shadow minister. What it allows you to do is, then you can go hammer and tongs at the government on every day, every issue. What the Congress not only lacks in its own organizational ability, also the myriad issues that the government gives you, but you are not able to capitalize on it. Now, people also need to be told, this is what the government is saying, this is the truth. This is what the government is saying, this is a lie. This is what the government is saying, we are going to hammer you. Where is that happening? And that is why I'm saying is that even 250 is not possible, which the Congress could have done. I am saying, yes, you don't have the money, agreed. I am saying you don't have the manpower, agreed. But the question is, without having any of these, just by having the goodwill of so many years and the people who still believe in the constitution and democracy and liberalism, you would still be able to stop a party from going 300 plus. Are you doing that much also? My answer to that is absolutely no.
Yeah, and I think somewhere Shashi Tharoor has this Mr. Good Guy image. Though, I mean, his life has not been short of controversies. But at the same time, he has this Mr. Good Guy image. And, I'm getting reminded of this book called The Fifth Horseman by Larry Collins and Dominic Lapierre, in which they talk about an American president who says that, do I respect Gandhi? Yes. Do I respect Jesus Christ? Yes. But I can't be Gandhi or Jesus Christ because I am the commander-in-chief of my country. So, do we sometimes associate that kind of charismatic persona, the leader, someone like a Modi, who can really drive something forward, and somewhere down the line, people are not seeing that kind of personality in someone else at this time?
So Modi derives a lot of his image and persona out of how we as Indians behave. He, his advisors, his party has acute understanding of how people behave and react. Somebody remarked it so well. Don't we all have a Dadaji in the family? Don't we all have an elderly patriarch in the family? A lot of movies, Amitabh Bachchan is this patriarch, Bhishma Pitama, long beard, wise man, not to be questioned, authoritative figure, benevolent leader. His benevolence keeps the whole family together. These are all thoughts that have been subtly ingrained. When kids today talk about the Prime Minister, they don't say PM Modi or Modi, they say Modi ji. It is a very subtle inculcation of this grandfatherly figure who takes care of us and takes care of our nation. He's the supreme benefactor of this nation. also decisive. I think what has happened is because of the progressives and the liberals being so confused about what they want to do, what they stand for, whether be it Biden and the Democrats or whether it be the Congress party and Rahul Gandhi here, people want action. I think there's a very good House of Cards, there is a very good monologue also of how people love slogans and how people love action. And I was like, has House of Cards been written for American democracy or has it been written for our democracy? But I think it's the same. When we see a decisive leader, somebody who is absolutely in control, appears to be in control, we just fall head over heels with that person. And Modi has been able to create that image. Would the Congress's response to Pulwama been a Balakot airstrike or Uri? I don't know. If you ask me what has been the most decisive action of this government, it hasn't been in the state of welfare, but definitely in national security.
Probably not.
They went hammer and tongs.
Yeah, probably not, because I remember Manmohan Singh and can't remember who the Pakistani Prime Minister was at the time, and went to Egypt and be like, oh, we both are victims of terror right after the Mumbai terror attacks. It was so hilarious.
So while, which is true, that it is, of course, the deep state that is organizing these terror attacks. And it happened in Vajpayee's time also, when he did try to do the Lahore bus service. And then, of course, you had him being stabbed in the back with Kargil. And the Pakistani deep state has always done that. The army, the ISI is always implicit in it. But what Modi did was send out a loud and clear message. Did it work politically? Yes. Did it work strategically? Well, that's a debatable issue also, because what has happened is India has sent out a clear message. And what is not often debated is how immensely grateful we should be is because of years of diplomatic efforts after 26/11 and the international community and international geopolitics that put Pakistan on a back bench and on notice with their FATA notification, where they would be put into the terror gray list, where any more terror attacks originating out of Pakistan, they would just be completely devoid of any more funding because they were so close to be called a terror state. So, aisa nahi hai that it was only the missiles at Balakot or the surgical strike at Uri, while which is needed. There is also the diplomatic efforts and years of diplomatic effort to put Pakistan on the back foot to almost declare it as a terror state that resulted in the establishment saying that we can't afford any more actions like the 26/11. Would the Pakistan deep state still want to do stuff like that? I'm sure. Can they do it at this point of time with their, you know, literally in a begging bowl? Thankfully, no. So that also has benefited. So national security is something that the BJP is really, really going to go to people to ask for a vote for. So much so that even in the state assembly elections, national security has become this electoral issue, which was never the case earlier. We have always seen, achha, India mein toh state issues hota hai, phir national issues hota hai. People vote differently. I think what BJP is actively trying to do that is to change it and make it all about a national leader, a national issue, and therefore you should vote in your state assembly elections also because of the national point of view.
Yeah, that is so true. And, you know, I always wanted to ask someone who observes the political space really closely, and I think, you know, we can end the podcast on this note as well, is that, you know, considering that Modi and the BJP have such supreme power, I mean, you know, you can call it kind of a monopoly, right? I mean, with the kind of predictions that we have for the 2024 elections, with such enormous power, they could have done anything. But at the same time, have they been a little better than what we thought they would be? In the sense that, you know, let's say, you know, let's go back to 2014. And let's say that, you know, the Congress government has done, you know, the 2G scam and the Commonwealth Games and all of that, you know, it's marred by controversy. And Modi is going to come. And the indication or the hawa is that Modi is going to stay for the next 20 years. And I remember, you know, people saying that, hey, if Modi comes to power, it's going to be very divided and all of that. Looking back, I mean, now that we are 9 years down the line, do you think it was not as bad as you thought it would be?
So let me answer that in two ways. So the first is the good part. I think after so many years of this whole coalition politics, people wanted stability. I think the vote also to the BJP, of course, there is this whole religious angle to it and identity politics. But a lot of people who think and vote or who would know politics or who read a lot, would even they, I mean to say the educated, the upper class, would vote for stability. There is also, again, the numbers might not show it in as much, but a sense of, no, law and order is better. And definitely in a state like UP, I can tell you that that is the case. Why? Is because, for example, the Samajwadi Party had its own free will. See, BJP is a very disciplined party. In the Samajwadi Party, I still remember I was at Akhilesh's first swearing-in ceremony, which is about 15 years ago. And 5 minutes after Akhilesh leaves the stage, and there is a cake that had been cut. And 5 minutes after Akhilesh leaves the stage, all the Samajwadi Party workers attack the cake. And it is like a mini riot on the stage. And cake is on the ground. They're trying to pick it on the ground. They're fighting with each other. It's chaos.
Maramari.
For me, it showed what this party is made of. And that is why every other small leader of Samajwadi Party would become a don and do his own extortion. Is the BJP absolutely pure and devoid of any sort of corruption? No. But whatever would happen would not happen in this brazen way. And I think that is what people had come to completely hate. One of the reasons why BJP came back into power, even in a coalition state, at least in a coalition way in Bihar, was that today also people are very, very scared of the jungle Raj of Lalu. That scar is, imagine the scarring is so bad that people who, when I would say anything about Bihar, they said, you bloody shut up. You have no idea what we have been through. You have no right to talk about it. Same way about Bengal. One of the reasons why BJP would, and by the way, BJP is really trying very hard in Bengal, because let's not forget, Bengal sends, if I'm not wrong, 41 or 42 Lok Sabha MPs. It's a huge catchment area as well. Of course, UP is and Bihar is, but Bengal and Maharashtra are next. And one of the reasons why BJP will win is not because suddenly they people have become, you know, Hindu or you know, Kattar Hindu. It's because they are so fed up. Because you had 35 years of the left rule. Then Mamata Banerjee comes and says, I will do Pariborton. And then she does the same thing as the left. She's nothing but left part two. Same policy, same tactic, same strong arm. And that is why the BJP is seeing an opportunity when people will be fed up. So it's not like everybody was absolutely pure before the BJP. It's not like BJP is absolutely pure. Have things turned to the better? I would say BJP is a better governed party. I think if they put their minds onto something, they are capable of doing it. Look at the parliament. Not only don't think about the temple, look at the parliament that they've built. How many years did that parliament come in suddenly? The question is, what does the BJP do with this power? While the law and order situation, I hope the economy improves much more. As we discussed earlier also, it needs to improve much more. Even 8% is not good enough. But what is the price? Are people willing to pay the price? Truth be told, I think people are willing to pay the price of democracy. If that means that if I get a little bit of stability and the law and order situation improves and I don't see nepotism at the forefront, would I be okay in surrendering my right to question, right to criticize? I would tilt towards the answer of saying people are okay in giving up their democratic rights. Because I think we might just shift a little bit towards, I've had comments saying what is wrong in the Chinese model. I've had people commenting on YouTube that they think that if you bring autocracy, automatically we will improve. Ki hum bhi Dubai ban jayenge, hum bhi Singapore ban jayenge. That might not be the case. You may have an autocratic leader and yet the economy doesn't perform. But I think the understanding at this point of time is, कोई बात नहीं, इतने सवाल पूछने की जरूरत नहीं है, सरकार कर रही है, सोच के ही कुछ कर रही है, हमारा भला होगा, मैं चाहता हूं भला हो. If actually that means that we all become progressive, and a lot of times I tell people, dude, if we become progressive, I get more ads, I get more subscription, I will also be better off, na? But is that going to happen? I don't think so. I don't think this country is made in a way where people will shut up and they will do their job and the country will progress. I don't think India is made that way. India is chaos. India is democracy. India is speaking up. India is opposition. India is fluid. India is going to progress, but at a slower rate. But if you take all of this away from India and say that kal se hum China ban jayenge, in a few years' time, it will not work. That is my reading of this country. I may be wrong.
Yeah. I think it's the diversity and the number of states that we have that has prevented a complete autocratic government.
But one election, one state might be coming very soon. Na? There have already started consultations for one election, one country, one election, one nation, one election. And one nation, one election, if it happens, that means we get election one in 5 years and the states are already gravitating towards voting for central issues. Then you know very well that. And of course, I mean, this is not a secret. Amit Shah has said it, that we want to be in power for the next 50 years. It's on record that he said it, that if the Congress can be in power for so many years, why can't we dream to be in power? And which is okay to dream politically. He has every right to say that.
Yeah. Why can't we have ambitions? Well, on that note, Akash, thank you so much, the Deshbhakt, being on the show. I know we went way beyond time, but it was a great discussion. I don't think this can ever end. There were so many things that yes. I had jotted down to discuss. So maybe we'll sit down another time, maybe yes. after the elections. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me over. Yes, no problems that we went over time. It was a very interesting discussion. Yes, these discussions can continue. My only point is, there was a time just a few years ago that you and I, even if we came from a different point of view, I will not start abusing your parents and you will not start to threaten to kill me or to boycott me. Can people with different divergent point of views also sit down and just have a conversation without becoming personal? Because that is what democracy was, having a discussion at the tea stall, whether be it a leftist or whether be it a right wing, whether be it a congressy, sitting and having a discussion, agreeing to disagree. Can we just have the concept of agreeing to disagree on certain issues and trading opinions and not abuses on some other issues? I think that's the aim.
Yeah, we hope that happens. And I think YouTubers like yourself and, you know, I mean, some of the other names that come to mind is Dhruv Rathi, Mohak Mangal. You guys are doing a great job in, you know, providing unbiased views from both sides. So that's
many great. Might disagree on that. Many might disagree, but anyways.
Well, I mean, that's the beauty of YouTube, right? I think it has, you know, I'm just using the word, brought down the bar of entry to media and to influencers. And it's good in a way, because I mean, the yeah. more diverse voices that we have, people can pick and choose. And the more diverse voices they listen to, I think they also grow as a person. So I think
And I always say this, listen to more people. I'm not saying listen only to Deshbhakt. Listen, understand, appreciate, apply your mind. It's not what is just coming to you. Believe it blindly. If the person is talking about something, has that person given you facts? Is this person making sense? What are the old videos of this person? Has this person gone wrong? Today, we are living in an age where people are selling, 15-year-olds are coming and selling trading classes. They are telling us how to do trading when they are 15 years old.
Yeah.
So the kind of stuff that people can believe is ridiculous. Don't believe everything. Question everything, including this conversation that we are having. Was this paid for somebody? Are we propagating some agenda here? Have that open mind and not do, you know, useless worship of people.
Yeah, that is so true. Well, Akash, thank you again. And we hope we can catch up soon, maybe after the elections.
Sure. Awesome. Thanks for having me over. Bye.